from WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack.
And I'm Emma Rae Stein.
It's great to be back again to share a weekly review of Connections. What's up first, Emma Rae?
We'll start this week's podcast with a conversation with philanthropist and Paychex founder Tom Golisano. He's written a new book about business strategies called Built, Not Born. And he joined us to talk about that and his thoughts on the presidential race.
In this clip, Golisano weighs in on why he thinks so many young people are expressing an interest in socialism. Let's listen.
In talking to my children and my grandchildren about their educations at the secondary school level, it's not like capitalism is extolled as a great virtue, a great economy, a great way to build wealth in a country. It's like it's demeaning. And when you have situations like three candidates or two candidates up there on the stage demeaning people that have achieved great success, you can understand why they're concerned about it. Also, I think socialism as an idea, as a concept, comes around to a civilization or to an economy on a regular basis. But as soon as people realize it's not the way to go, it's not the way to build a good quality of life, they turn away from it. I think we're just going through one of those stages now.
Do you think it's possible that in the current system, people are legitimately hurting and they're not feeling the kinds of effects or rewards that you would hope capitalism would have?
Well, let's face a reality, Evan. No matter how great your economy is, no matter how much wealth has been created in your country, you have to understand there's always a bell curve of wealth or success. You know what I mean by bell curve? 10% at the high end, 10% at the low end. So no matter how good your economy is, you always have a bell curve, and there's always going to be people at the low end of it. Now, I think the great thing about the United States, considering that bell curve, the people at the lower end probably have a better lifestyle and living conditions than they do any place else in the world. I'm not sure of that, but I'm guessing that. So no matter how successful we are as the economy, you're always going to have a low end of the socioeconomic curve.
I think that's what probably animates the Sanders campaign, is that a belief that the people on one end of that curve, the hurting end of that curve, are not experiencing a good life, even when they feel like they're working hard. I think that's what Ezra Klein was saying. And it sounds like you either dispute that they're struggling or that you think that that's sort of a natural product of a capitalistic society.
I think it's a natural product of a capitalistic society, which I think in the end, we've all seen concepts or understood concepts where everybody is treated exactly the same no matter how hard they work. Generally, your level of productivity goes down and goes down substantially, just like the old classroom, you know, where the teacher marks on the curve, mm-hmm. and everybody passed, but everybody did the same level of work, and nobody excelled. Sooner or later, your quality or productivity is going to go down in that environment.
Yeah, and I think people look at someone like Jeff Bezos, who has amassed many, many billions of dollars, and they look at employees in the warehouse who are, I mean, literally wearing diapers because they don't feel like they have enough time to go to the bathroom, and thinking, why has one guy got billions of dollars when the people he's employing don't have enough time to make a restroom break, and thinking that is a broken kind of society, capitalism or not. Do you disagree?
Well, first of all, I'd be very surprised if that environment exists in an American company. If it did, I'd say shame on them, but I doubt very much if it exists. But the fact of the matter is, in a capitalistic society, everybody has opportunity. Now, you might say, well, not everybody has equal opportunity, but everybody does have opportunity to a certain degree. It's pretty level situation.
Do you think?
You know, when I started Paychex, I had no idea where it was going to end up. But I kept working on it. I tried to keep making it grow and be more productive and be more profitable. And I look back and I say, well, gee, I created 15,500 jobs across the country. That people are pretty economically secure. We provide a very valuable service to 670,000 companies. Why should I feel guilty about becoming a billionaire? I worked hard. I created a lot of value. And you, as you mentioned, the philanthropy is significant that I've been able to give to organizations that are deserving of it. And the security that I've created for so many people in so many shareholders.
Yeah, I think most Americans would agree, generally speaking, that if you work hard, you ought to be successful. And I would share your concern.
Well, that's not true, Evan. I'm gonna stop you right there. Working hard is not the only criteria. Did you ever hear the expression, you keep your shoulder to the wheel? The only thing you're sure of is getting a sore shoulder. You got to work hard, but you also got to be intelligent and smart about what you're doing.
Okay, and that's...
You understand what I'm saying?
Well, I read your book, absolutely, and we're going to talk about those tenets coming up here in just a second, because, by the way, for listeners, I mean, Tom's got a lot to say about what it means to work smart, not just work hard. So I take that point, Tom. I think, just generally speaking, though, people would look at Michael Bloomberg and say, you were innovative, you filled a need, you identified a problem and you solved it, and you made money, and you worked hard and you worked smart and you made money. But making $60 billion is not the same as working hard and working smart to most people, I think, and being well off. $60 billion is excessively well off to a lot of Americans who can work hard, maybe not be as innovative, but at the same time work hard every day and have one injury and they go to the ER and they feel like they're bankrupt. I mean, that's where I think people are, maybe beyond just the educational system, feeling like, is this system working? If one guy's got $60 billion and I'm working hard every day and I fell and broke my ankle and now I may be bankrupt, then I'm not sure this is working. Does that make sense?
Don't you think it's a good idea to have people like Michael Bloomberg, who have done so well successfully, who creates an incentive, who creates a vision for people to be able to accomplish what he accomplished? I think it's terrific that we have Michael Bloomberg's and Jeff Bezos. Those people have created fantastic organizations. They employ hundreds of thousands of people. Where would those people be working if Michael Bloomberg didn't do what he did or Jeff Bezos didn't do what he did? They might be working, but they're probably working for a lot less dollars. So I credit those people with performing well and doing a great service to our economy.
Next, we're going to have a conversation with acclaimed Irish tenor and Paralympian Ronan Tynan. Tynan was born with a lower limb disability and had both of his legs amputated at the age of 20 after a car accident. Since then, he has used prosthetic legs.
In this clip, Tynan discusses his experiences growing up with his disability, and he shares a story about how he has come to laugh at some of his more unpredictable moments. Here he is.
When I was born in the 60s, and at that time, particularly in Ireland, if there was a child with a physical disability or even mentally challenged, you know, there was not enough education for the public to know what to do. So a lot of them would look for, how I would say it, is places in which to put their children because they didn't know how to do it themselves. But I was blessed with a very determined mother who wanted me to grow up same as everybody else. Now, I spent 3 years, when the bones are 3 years in a hospital, I was a twin as well. And my parents never, ever once gave me the sense of abandonment. When things weren't going the way my mother wanted, she decided to take complete control. And she was like, you would describe her as a Renaissance woman. She decided to find out what were the latest developments in prosthetics and orthotics, and decided, right, we're going to England. So she brought me to London to a hospital called Queen Mary's Hospital, Roehampton. And it was there that I was fitted with prosthetics so as that I would have artificial limbs that would give me the stature she felt that was right for my age. And then once she got that going, she was determined that I would attend a proper primary school, the same as my siblings, and that I would go to school in short pants so that people, yeah, he's a little different in his limbs and the way he walks, but she was always the point, let's put it in their face and let them not have the idea of, oh, what's wrong with them? Well, it's very evident what's wrong. So therefore, she gave me this, she instilled the confidence to kind of drive forward. My father, you know, I grew up in a farming community and I used to work on the farm the same way as Fiona and Tom. So I knew no different. I didn't see difference. Yes, of course, as time went on, you realize there's the element of the challenge of walking, running and participating. But that, again, didn't stop me because I created ways in which I could do things myself and participate in able-bodied sports. And so, you know, I was blessed with the kind of foresight they both had. But at that time, it was a tough time for parents to deal with children with disability. And also, it was a tough time for schools to kind of accept children who are disability because they didn't know how they would integrate into the school, you know. But I was very, you know, I was a very fortunate young kid, you know. I landed in the right family and things worked.
Well, you tell the story of walking through town one day when you were a young boy and a priest asking your mother if you were the weak little fella and your mother's reaction. Yeah. Can you tell that story?
Oh, my God. My mother was determined one day to walk me down to the town, which was about 3/4 of a mile from the house. And when we got to the post office, they were all looking over the counter at saying, oh, this is the child we haven't seen much of. And, you know, they naturally enough, they were inquisitive, you know, the sheltered child. But anyway, the unfortunate parish priest said, is this the weak one? Well, Mom went mad. She said, none of my children are weak. And she says, you're now seeing the strongest of them. And she was livid. She was livid. And my dad came down, I remember, in the car, and he was upset with her that she, a kind of, in his mind, paraded me. But she said, Ronan will have to understand that this is what the what public perception can be like. And we will change them. And I guess that's kind of fortitude within her. My father was kind of more soft and felt that, you know, it was a very tough lesson for me. But it was, for me, it was a very valuable lesson. The only part I didn't like was the walk. That was tough. But other than that, people's perceptions of me, God, that never really bothered me. Plus, I was a smashing-looking kid. So, you know, I had a lot going on.
Talking to the remarkable Ronan Tynan, joining us from Ireland. He's coming to Rochester next month. He, of course, is an Irish tenor, a Paralympian, a physician, and a man who's been telling his story of resilience and success around the world. And so Ronan, I kind of just want to probe another aspect of this. I mean, you have a phenomenal sense of humor, obviously. And, you know, another...
You need to.
Well, that's kind of what I want to talk about because, you know, there's this story you tell. And the first time I heard it, I thought, I don't know, can I laugh at this? You said you were sitting on stage singing. And we're told to sort of just sing and kind of make these gestures, and you're at this performance, and then your right leg fell off into the orchestra pit. It fell off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, and I'm going, well, I don't want to laugh at this, but you're making me laugh.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing. The audience didn't laugh at this either.
I imagine they were very concerned.
Well, you see, here's the thing. It was a wonderful opportunity to do an operetta called Land of Smiles by Franz Lehár. And I was partnered with, you know, a very strong, well-built soprano. And the problem didn't start at the point you're describing. It started way earlier. Mm-hmm. She was wearing this magnificent golden dress and it had a long train. And in the process of descending down a stairwell, there was an acute bend and she leaned in and I kind of moved her out a bit because I got a little nervous. And my foot was on the train and as she took about 3 steps, the train came away and, as I say, behold, I saw a vision. And this is, what can you do? But she was supposed to come over stage right in front of the orchestra pit and I was to sing the love aria. So I went over there on my own and looked back and there was no sign of her coming over, which is fine. And in the process of singing, the producer had said, to get physical and demonstrative of your passion. So seemingly, I turned to the right to look at her and I kicked out and the leg fell into the pit. Now, this is a different kind of operetta that most people would have seen. So instead of being singing a high note, I dropped a leg. And I will not forget it because the poor old cellist got a heart attack, you know, and I just looked down at him. And do you know those unearthly silences when nobody says anything? And you have 2,500 people looking at you thinking, Sacred Heart of God, what just did happen? And you're looking down the cellist saying, can you hand me up my leg? Just hand me up my leg. And he handed it back, handshaking. You'd swear I had leprosy. So I had to put the whole thing back on and went stage right behind the curtain, got it all sorted. And the producer was crying her eyes out. And she said, how much more of you can fall apart? Well, you know, you have to accept the good with the bad. And the thing is, in life, you're presented with all sorts of challenges, some of which you don't make yourself, but unfortunately involve you. And you have to adapt straight away, not to crumble, and just say, yeah, look, it's who I am, it's part of me, let's keep going, the show has to stay going, and you move on. Of course, that lady never performed with me ever again.
We'll end the week with a conversation about a new exhibit at the Visual Studies Workshop called Evidence. It explores perceptions of Black masculinity and gender identity.
In this clip, yoga instructor Brandon Stroud discusses his experiences as a Black man in America in 2020. Let's listen.
Thinking about safety, like I think my Brister and I have like been in situations where we were just living our lives. Like, the first thing I thought about was safety was, like, we were out in Toronto for
two different
occasions. one was New Year's, and one of our more effeminate-bodied sisters in the community was with us. And because of their attire, these people in the hotel, like, stopped when we walked in the hotel. And we were looking really cute. Like, we was fly. We were really fly that night. And a statement was made to them, and the first thing Adrian and I did was, first of all, they handled the situation themselves, like, to defuse. And
shout
Adrian and I was there, and it was like a swoop-in method, because we didn't know. Like, we weren't near home. We were in a hotel as guests, so at any point in time, they see these Black queer bodies in this space, and maybe they think, like, oh, they're about to start trouble. And it was like, no, but they started with us. And how in that time could we create safety for ourselves in that space? And then the other time was when we were out at a club in Toronto. I think it was the Afrobeats and Soca party we had to. And Adrian and I were dancing, like, enjoying ourselves, living. And then you could see the other Black bodies who were clearly queer identifying, like, wait, what is going on? Like, we can be this free. And, like, yes, nobody bothered us. Like, everybody was so sweet in that instant, right? I was like, oh, my gosh, like, who are these people? Like, where did... Literally saying this, y'all must be from America because we don't do that over here. And so we were just like, oh, okay. and even thinking about an incident when I was out with my partner and, like, people have said things and my partner is this, like, bigger guy. Like, when you see him, he's, like, big, brolic dude. And so he's like also this giant, like, just beautiful being. And we talk about those differences a lot to where I may respond and he was like, babe, you can't respond like that. And I was like, well, I'm gonna fight for both of us or something, like, you know, like like, I'm gonna call people, I'm gonna do whatever. And so that's my first instinct, where his first instinct of safety of, we don't even have to acknowledge them and still be safe in our own bodies and still keep it pushing, where mine is like, if somebody comes over here and starts some trouble with me or my man, like, I'm ready to go. Like, and that, but that's been the mindset that I've had to grow up in because of the spaces of, because, like, being at high school parties and getting jumped, being in college and getting jumped, like, joining a fraternity and, like, even thinking about what the space of Black fraternities have done inside of our community and be like, I'm gonna be this, like, Bayard Rustin is one of my fraternity brothers, and I follow in his greatness of just trying to be free. And then you recognize, like, this man had to be in so much peace in his mind, body, and soul at all times to sit there and be like, okay, this is fine. My friends are stuffing me in the back of a car trunk so that people will be a part of this this bus boycott movement. And so if I'm there, my presence is going to do something to them. And so, like, living in that duality of, like, knowing that your presence is either going to be this great respected thing and people see you as this beautiful being and creature moving throughout the world. And then other times you have to be like, okay, if I'm riding through whatever neighborhood, do I have to throw my head up or do I need to nod towards them? Because that those head nods can mean two different things when it comes to safety. Like, just existing in me, like, okay, we're going to do this. Mm. And, like, living in that and still being like, okay, I'm a little scared right now. I don't know what's really going to happen, but, like, we're going to make it work.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
You can also hear us on the WXXI mobile app. She's Megan, and I'm Emery. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you on Monday.